So it's now my honour to give you the word of encouragement. And the theme for today is confusion. We're going to look at confusion and how it's a particular kind of problem. It's what I would call a silent killer. We want to learn from the scriptures, from Genesis in particular, some lessons, and take a rather uncompromising and strong and direct look at our spiritual mirrors, at the possibility of confusion being in our own lives. And then we'll take some encouragement from the Bible and before we remember Christ. So a definition of confusion for me is disorderliness, a lack of clarity or a mixing of ideas, an incoherence. And just to list some of the different types of confusion that we have in our lives. We have confusion as to what to do. Do we offer help or keep quiet? We suffer dilemmas with pros and cons on both sides, and it's difficult to decide what to do. We're sometimes confused which direction to go in, unless we have a good map reader. Sometimes we suffer confusion as to what we've just seen with our eyes. Magic tricks and optical illusions are an example, or an unusual event that we don't see very often. We have to have a double take, don't we? We also might not be able to see well enough that dark cupboard or the small print in a legal contract. We also have confusion due to lack of information. Maybe we don't know when the bus is coming or what clothes we should wear to an event. We suffer confusion due to bad communication. Someone's unclear with us and we didn't verify what they meant. Sometimes we suffer confusion due to a conflict of interest. We have two people who are our superiors at work and they don't get on and they give us two different competing things to do. Or we suffer confusion because of pride and wrong beliefs. We sometimes second guess someone that we're talking to because we believe they're wrong or they've made an error of judgment. And maybe they haven't. Maybe it's us that's too proud to accept what they're saying. We suffer confusion due to medical conditions, memory loss and Alzheimer's, to name a couple. And of course, we suffer confusion because we didn't listen. We got the response wrong. We make mistakes, don't we, as well? Recently, someone came to stay and they mixed the tea and the coffee together, which we found out later was not a good drink. So confusion is terribly easy. It probably occurs more often than it doesn't. And I want to take a quick example of this talk I'm giving now. When I wrote this, I knew what I meant as I was thinking. And then I wrote it down, and between that time and the time I'm saying it, I've forgotten perhaps some of the feeling that I had at the time. So now I'm having to read my own thoughts. But because I have a different background to you, I use different words. I have different experiences, a different education. And so the way I express my thoughts are different to the way you would express the same thought. And yet you can hear my words, you can interpret them yourself with your background, and then later you could perhaps talk to me about a thought you had based on my thoughts. It's actually an incredibly complicated thing, this just simple act of communication. It's frightening how confused a very simple message could become. There's so much opportunity for error. The peculiar and interesting quality about confusion is that it's quite often born out of a lack of awareness on our part. We simply have no idea that we have made a mistake. We're unaware of it. We don't know what we don't know. We misunderstand silently. We're victims of circumstance, and we don't know it. It's as if we're looking the other way when someone we're meeting walks in. Or when you phone a friend and you pick up the telephone at the same time and the line is engaged. You know, you just absolutely don't know the reason for that to happen. But it's a confusing event. Confusion is insidious, it's silent, and it's final. You can't confirm that you misunderstood something because you don't know you did. It's a fog that surrounds us all the time without us being aware of it. So how do we fight something like this? How do we be on our guard against it? And how do we recover from it? Because we all suffer from it. So this is where experience comes in, isn't it? The rules of the circumstance, the extra padding around the message that we don't strictly need. We call it the context. We compare scripture with scripture. We have many broad themes and we have specific detail that must fit into those broad themes. In society, we use manners and politeness to tell us what language to expect from a person. We use body language. We use how somebody dresses to provide a context. What kind of person is this? They wouldn't really have said what I think they just said. Other checks and balances are grammar and syntax and punctuation, all of which are designed to get rid of misunderstanding. And we also have tradition. We vote on things so that we can go back afterwards and clarify a position which we may have forgotten about. So how does all of this apply to our spiritual lives? Well, the list of confusions above, they're all about the human senses, how we perceive the reality around us. And we recognize that we are made in the image of God. We are creatures with a spiritual dimension, and we are truly we're spiritual beings. All of what it means to be a fully functioning human being and to lead a full life is our human senses plus this spiritual dimension that animals don't have. And they're all subject to confusion. So it's necessarily the fact that it impacts on our spiritual understanding too. Somebody needs to tell us, don't they, when we've misunderstood. They need to tell us in love. They need to give us a friendly warning or rebuke or a word of instruction. And that takes bravery. And I want to quickly look at the example of confusion, perhaps the best known one, and God's reaction to it, which is the Tower of Babel. So in Genesis 11, verses 1 to 4, we read this. The whole world had only one language, and everyone spoke it. They moved to the east and found a broad valley in Babylon. There they made their home. And they said to one another, "Come on, let's make bricks and bake them well." They used bricks instead of stones. They used tar to hold the bricks together. Then they said, "Come on, let's build a city for ourselves. Let's build a tower that reaches to the sky. We'll make a name for ourselves. Then we won't be scattered over the whole earth." Their sin wasn't tower building or organizing themselves together in unity of purpose. Their guilt was in their self-reliance, their self-glorification, their self-interest, and their self-determination. It was a common belief from ancient times, right up until about the 16th century, that the sky was solid, and these people were going to build a tower that reached to the sky. In our spiritual lives, we have similar thoughts, don't we? The bigger and better the church, the more organized or effective. The faster it grows, the more people in it, the more young people in it. The better the preaching, the more people that come to the lecture. Perhaps we would like our religious deeds to be noticed by people. We consider, don't we, in our lives, what we wear, what we buy, and what we drive. Everything reflects on us. We speak more carefully around strangers. Our accent goes up a couple of notches in company. We're built with an audience in mind. In this world, self-promotion is the order of the day. It's the air we breathe. It's like a lukewarm tide we swim in. It's very hard to detect when we're being carried away by this idea of making a name for yourself. These Babylonian people were confused, though, long before God confused their language. They were confused about where true, lasting joy lay, about security and about the purpose in their lives. We know where our joy lies. Our security lies in our communication with God. They felt that their security lay with their communication, their brick-building technology, their techniques for building, their engineering accomplishments, their workers. They felt that they just needed to have a unity of purpose, to collaborate, and they would be like gods, I suppose. And this is the defining characteristic of the world in which we find ourselves. They took earthly things, mud and pitch, while today, in the world we live in, we have metal and electricity. We may look back through history and despise their ancient and primitive toy town quest to build a little skyscraper, even though it was perhaps only a few stories high. And we may think we're so different today. Our highest building is 3,000 feet tall. It would take 15 minutes to travel up to the top if you went in a normal lift. It's an enormous structure compared to what they built. We may look down on the ancients, but we're absolutely equal to them in every way that counts. Humans are the same today that they were 4,000 years ago. Where was their clarity of direction? Was it self-defined? Or were they submitting to God's commands? Of course they weren't. From Adam to Noah, God instructed men to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. But instead, they took the exact opposite position. They said, come on, let's make a name for ourselves, then we won't be scattered over the whole earth. The unity they found was the unified effort to disobey God. They had unity and peace and enough food to feed the workers. They had prosperity and time and comfort, none of which are by themselves important. We need to get our motivation and our goal right. There's even honor and peace and security among thieves. But peace and prosperity and order in this society is not by itself a measure of success. For unity and decency and orderliness, they're all laudable, but they're also all human. We must also search out the things of God, his purpose in our lives, and show our faith by submission and obedience, even when it might appear to us that following God is harder in some circumstances than following our own hearts. We need to surround ourselves with those who speak our language, who have the same aims, that hold to each other and encourage each other, but that's not enough. We must also have the commands of God as our primary focus and motivation, not traditions or man's ideas, which may be more comfortable. We cannot help but remember at this time the chilling warning to the church of the Laodiceans. Jesus says, "You say, 'I am rich, I've become wealthy and don't need anything,' but you don't realize how pitiful and miserable you've become. You are poor, blind, and naked." And what a terrible letter to get from Jesus. And what about the letter to Sardis? "I know what you are doing. People think you're alive, but you're dead. Wake up, strengthen what's left, or it will die. You have not done all that my God wants you to do. So remember what you have been taught and have heard and hold firmly to it." So can you imagine the feelings of the ecclesia on receiving this letter? They would have been in utter shock. Feelings of conviction, of having to face up to Jesus' view of them, of needing to change, of needing to listen to their consciences. "I should have just done what I knew I should have been doing all along." Many of them would have felt that fog of confusion of being presented with facts that they had previously ignored. What we're learning from Babel is that we can, without realizing, have the appearance of godliness and the observance of ritual without a living faith and without love. In fact, we can all be wealthy and stable and upstanding, decent, nice, communicative, obliging, hard workers. We can be clever, organized, well-mannered, orderly and sensible, and sober. But if we step back, those are all qualities that it takes to build a tower. If nothing spurs us on towards spiritual growth, if nothing pushes us out of the comfort of our comfort zone or makes us question our motives, we just get comfortable. We sit down and we build our towers. We decide on what to buy and when. and how to organize our lives for ourselves to make it more easy. It's a subtle, warm, and inviting sort of prison, and our religion becomes a weekly addiction, and we lose our way in the doing of it all. If we're not careful, we also believe that we're building somehow our way up to heaven. We can, by doing, gain this elevation, reaching up to God in the things we do, as if that's enough to bridge the gap. We are unified, we are self-confident, but perhaps we're lacking in something. So to me, confusion is a sort of spiritual carbon monoxide. It's tasteless, it's odorless, it's colorless and invisible. And it can build up around us without us being aware of it. And as it does so, we become more sleepy, and of course it leads to death. But we each have in our hand a spiritual carbon monoxide detector, don't we? So I suppose we all have these words of Jesus in the back of our minds. Not everyone who says to me, "Lord, Lord," shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. So we carry on in Genesis 11 and verse 5 to 9. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower the people were building, and he said, "All these people are united and speak the same language. That's why they all do this. Now they will be able to do anything they plan." God recognizes that they will be a success by their organization and their unity, but without him at their center, he knows what that will mean. He's previously promised that he would never again destroy the earth with a flood, but leaving these people alone to build their ziggurat up to the sky would result in a unity of godliness, idol worship, and corruption. If the human mind and heart is where bad ideas get conceived, get thought of, then cities are the birthplaces of the results. Anonymity, passing by your neighbour, acting as you please with no comeback, lawlessness, poverty, homelessness, lack of family and society, no connection with each other, disease, depravity and loneliness, and every evil imagination of the heart. The only thing separating them from this fate was their observance of God's clear direction to populate the whole earth, and he had to restrain them. Genesis 11, verse 7. "Come on, let's go down and mix up their language. Then they will not be able to understand one another." I've actually had conversations with atheists about this verse. They get incredibly angry about it. They say God is a malicious interferer, an unjustified confuser and meddler in human greatness, and he must be somehow jealous of human aspiration, that he imposes his will on us in case we get too mighty. Which is incredible, isn't it? But we expect it from them. God is acting against the human will, and so godless humans are angry about that. But don't we see God's love and care in his actions? He's being gracious. He sent an angel to assess and react to their self-defeating actions. In verse 8, "So the Lord scattered them from there over the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. There the Lord mixed up the language of the whole world. That's why the city was called Babel. From there the Lord scattered them over the whole earth." And to me, that's amazing. With one simple action, the unity and the collective intelligence of man is turned on its head. And now those proud feelings of self-confidence change to frustration and suspicion and fear of each other and pain and panic. All the plans of their hearts are inexpressible and unworkable. And I always imagine at that time, even eating together would be hard. Perhaps the names of each other and the food and drink and common things are perhaps the only things they could actually communicate about. The 1 Corinthians 1 verse 25. "This foolish plan of God is wiser than the wisest of human plans, and God's weakness is stronger than the greatest of human strength." Let's take that message to heart. If we've temporarily begun to see life as a challenge and to fret about tomorrow, how we'll meet our heart's desires, living for our own pleasures, then we are building our towers. So let us submit to God's gracious hand of correction and pray for it to be in our lives to guide us, to move us out of our comfy ways of living and to wake us up from the cozy sleep of confusion. And let's be thankful when he disciplines us. And as I was writing this, I believe this is a call to action for me. I can see in my life a number of ways in which I will this week take action in my life. So believe me, I intend no criticism of anyone with these words. God looks at our hearts and we don't judge each other. And so therefore, these words are said in love. We don't know what Jesus... We know, don't we, that Jesus said, "Whoever is not with me is against me." It's so easy for confusion and lack of focus to become opposition. Anything which contends and distracts is not in our best interest. I want to give one example of that, which is we're all familiar with. And our first example is climate change. So the rich of yesterday have become the super rich of today. They own large multinational companies, and they're driven now by circumstance, by commercial self-interest, and by confused thinking into acting in a wholly damaging way that damages the population of the entire planet. You would think that something so universally agreed on, which is so terrible for the planet, would be stopped in its tracks. But instead, global climate change has been allowed to continue unchecked, with only a nod towards the solution. So we ask, why is that? Because those who are in power have a conflict of interest. And this is where this confused direction, it's not in man to direct his own steps. Politicians and business leaders, by leaving things as they are, speed the onset of the biggest money-making opportunity in human history. Once the ice melts over the Arctic, that ocean becomes open for business for the first time in human history. And now it will be possible to ship cargo from the Far East over the top of the planet, saving almost 5,000 miles over the current journey through the Panama Canal. There are also huge oil and gas deposits that they've previously not been able to get at. In the history of the world, there's never been a larger opportunity. I think it's 17 trillion in oil alone. So for some time now, the world's largest powers, whilst some of them have been negotiating about what to do to stop climate change, the other part of their countries have been vigorously negotiating for their share of this new market if they do nothing. It's a total confusion. Russia's even planted a flag on the bottom of the seabed under the North Pole. Humanity is completely connected as never before, isn't it? Through technology. It's got a global purpose. There's agreement on tax and trade and communication, on the way money flows, on the way the markets operate, and international law. And all of that allows the whole world to decide how to make maximum money from this planet. And God says, "I will destroy those who destroy the earth. If you are not for me, you are against me. In those last days, men shall be high-minded lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God." So many more verses describing the current age where the unity of mankind is used for godlessness. It's time, isn't it, for Jesus to come back before it goes too far. The way that God puts it in Mark 13, if those days had not been cut short, no one would survive. So we wonder how bad it will get. So, leaving aside the confusion of man and all that they have to offer us, what do we have to look forward to in the presence of God's government? Well, we imagine in our mind's eye, don't we, that cities will be one of the first things to become obsolete. They depend on all the infrastructure of man, all those things that destroy the earth, water and gas and all of that. Instead, we'll be living in a world of local society with local support and reputation-based pressure to love your neighbour and get on with each other. There'll be no more power-hungry, super-rich, hypocritical religions. but instead a personal relationship with God's representatives and teachers, with freedom to love him, with free from torture and persecution, free from being beheaded. There'll be no more big polluting business. There'll be a return to local farming practice and local bartering. And there'll be no more big oppressive, unjust, self-seeking governments. And there'll be a total lack of armies. I love that verse. They won't even learn war anymore. I mean, we teach war to our children, don't we? It's insane. And there'll be no more empires getting rich from the exploitation of poorer, weaker nations. And I was looking into this, and just a couple of facts as they start to emerge about the British Empire. And we know that many of the other empires were just as terrible. But when Obama took office, he had a bust of Winston Churchill sent back to England. And the reason for that was that his granddad was imprisoned and tortured for 2 years for resisting Churchill's activities in Kenya. Almost 100,000 Kenyans died in 9 years there. Almost 30 million died of starvation in India while we were shipping their wheat to us. And under the British in Bengal, in 1943, 4 million of them starved to death while we delivered their food to British soldiers and countries in Greece, like Greece. So, and about that activity, the famine in Bengal, Churchill says this, and I quote, "I hate Indians. They're a beastly people with a beastly religion. The famine was their own fault for breeding like rabbits." And I found that shocking, you know. We sort of have a high opinion of Churchill, and it cut me dead. Of course, other empires are bad, but the one we hold perhaps most closely to our own, you know, culture, you know, we should not pick sides. We can't pick a good human side. There's no such thing as a good human government. We stand aside, don't we, brothers and sisters? We're waiting for a righteous government. We're not bystanders, though, but we stand aside. We still care for our neighbours and we show our love and compassion. After all, it was Jesus who attracted great audiences because of his compassion. But we just don't get involved in it. So there'll be no more empires in this wonderful new kingdom. There'll be no more human trafficking, no more slavery, no more war or crime or crying or disease. It will be as if everybody just returned to their houses and to their families and minded their own business and tended their gardens. It will all just stop. We will get that call from the angel, and that will be the beginning of that stop. The whole earth will be refreshed. It will be very obvious who Jesus is and what men must do. And people will be forced to adjust. They will be educated away from all of this nationalism and racial superiority and female oppression and power and corruption. There will be a huge amount of very normal, very average, poor, weak, blind and deaf and naked and oppressed people who will be weeping with joy at this new empire, while those that were powerful grind their teeth in frustration at their losses. The prisons will be opened, the slaves will be freed, and oppressed men and women will be free to come out without fear for the first time in their lives, free from the tyranny of banks, of intrusive laws, religious violence and death. And I personally imagine in my mind rusting CCTV cameras and rotting cars and empty roads, forgotten nuclear power bunkers. You know, everything that is not from God will be in a state of unused decay. So I want to read a few verses about that future kingdom so that we can truly fix in our minds what a difference it will be. And this is why we currently endure the experiences that God places in our lives. It's currently why we don't seek our own will. This image is to dispel any form of confusion. It's to focus our minds before we remember Christ. This is from Daniel, isn't it? One like a son of man, coming with clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Shout and be glad, O daughter of Zion, for I am coming, and I will live among you. The Lord will inherit Judah as his portion in the Holy Land and will again choose Jerusalem. I have installed my king on Zion, my holy hill, Christ as the King of glory, the chief shepherd. He will rule from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. In his days the righteous will flourish, prosperity will abound till the moon is no more. He will rule from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. The poor and the meek will be dealt with righteously. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. God will put his truth in the heart of man, and all will know the facts about Jesus Christ. With joy you will draw water from the wells of salvation. In that day you will say, "Give thanks to the Lord. Call on his name. Make known among the nations what he has done, and proclaim that his name is exalted. All nations will be blessed through him, and that the whole earth will be filled with his glory."